Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Zeki Sari-Toprak, professor of theology and religious studies, and director of the Bedu Zaman Saeed Nursi Chair in Islamic Studies at John Carroll University, about his exciting book, Islam's Jesus, published by the University of Florida Press in 2015. In Islam's Jesus, Zeki Sari-Toprak explores an old topic from a fresh perspective. The status of Jesus in Islam has been of interest for centuries and relates, of course, to both Christianity and Islam, but the level of synthesis that Professor Sari-Toprak's monograph offers is remarkable. He draws on a variety of Islamic literature, including commentaries on the Quran, works of theology, and collections of prophetic sayings. Moreover, he surveys not only the vast Arabic sources on his topic, but also Turkish sources, and his research covers multiple schools of thought and time periods. Another hallmark of the monograph is the attention it gives to Jesus' role in Islamic eschatology. Notably, Sari-Toprak demonstrates how mainstream as well as lesser-known Islamic discourses on eschatology encompass numerous hermeneutical strategies. Some, for example, understand the descent of Jesus as a physical phenomenon, while others understand it as a non-material spiritual phenomenon. The book highlights a number of other competing discourses as well, which are likely to challenge and even surprise the reader. The author's clear writing style, combined with meticulous attention to scholarly rigor and textual engagement, makes the text accessible to a range of readers, which should render it useful to general audiences, as well as scholars of eschatology, Christian-Muslim relations, Quranic studies, and other fields. Good morning, Zeki. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Elliot. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. And so it's our tradition here in New Books in Islamic Studies to ask our authors to tell us a little bit of background about themselves and how they got interested in your topic. So could you tell us a little bit about that? And if you had any influential mentors or scholarship that helped get you interested in your project?
Yeah, thank you. Since my college years, I have been studying in Islamic theology with an emphasis on Islamic eschatology. I did my exit thesis on the aesthetic argument on the existence of God. Then I did my master's thesis on al-Nasafi's idea, Sifat al-Takwin, which can be translated as creating as a divine attribute, which is very much debated between Asharites and Maturidites. Reading manuals of Islamic theology, I would frequently encounter a statement like, "We believe in the emergence of Antichrist, Al-Dajjal. We believe in the descent of Jesus, Nuzul Isa." So I was wondering, what is the meaning of Antichrist and how Jesus is coming? What is his Nuzul? Therefore, I decided to do my PhD dissertation on the concept of the Antichrist, Al-Dajjal. My dissertation was published in Turkish in 1992. Part of this research, actually, I published in English as an article for the Muslim World in the year 2003. Having studied the Antichrist, Jesus' antithesis, I thought now I have to write on Jesus as well.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So you got interested in Jesus on one level by looking at anti-Jesus or Antichrist, and then later went to study Jesus in this current project. And so since the title of the book is Islam's Jesus, could you say something a little bit about what went into your thinking about the title? So is it important? Were you thinking about it in the sense that Jesus belongs to Islam and sometimes other people think Jesus belongs to their tradition?
Actually, I didn't have that dichotomy, I would say, because from my reading of Islamic theology, Jesus was a part of Islamic theology. But what was striking for me is his coming, his descent, coming from sky. That was interesting for me. So that's why I dedicated, actually, later on this subject, my works.
Mm-hmm. And so in particular, since I'm familiar a little bit with some efforts that you have in terms of interfaith work and talking with people of all sorts of different religious backgrounds, have you had any interesting kind of encounters with people where you might just meet someone randomly and tell them about your research about Jesus and this sparks some kind of conversation?
I had many conversations prior to writing this book. I would say most of them were positive, but also I had some negative conversations as well. Some people who would say Muslims are degrading Jesus because they call him a prophet, and a prophet is a very, degrading term for Jesus. And of course, I had some arguments, against this idea that the concept of prophet is not a small concept in the Islamic tradition. Actually, Jesus is considered among the five elite prophets, who are considered the highest of all human beings: Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad. These are considered the highest of all human beings. So calling Jesus a prophet, I thought it was not degrading his message and his place in Islam.
So could you say a little bit more about that? Since a lot of people probably in English, when they hear the word Jesus, they connect it to Christianity and salvation and the Son of God. And so could you give us a brief overview of how Muslims have understood Jesus historically?
Well, as I mentioned in my book, there are more than 90 verses speaking of Jesus. And therefore, even a small hint in the Quran is significant about anything. So if there are many verses in the Quran speaking of Jesus, it becomes a very important figure of Islam. And that's why I called my book Islam's Jesus. Well, there are some differences between Islam and Christianity, but I would say my book is not in an apologetic way. It is much more academic and more focusing from an Islamic approach. Sometimes I give some ideas about the Christian approach very briefly, but that's not my goal. And also, it's not my goal to debate, my is better than yours. That's not my goal, actually, in this book. And some scholars who wrote some reviews of the book suggested that it has been written in a positive spirit. And that's the one that actually I intended to do.
And so given that there's a bit of scholarship about the role of Jesus in Islam, could you say a little about how your book fits into this larger body of scholarship that looks at Jesus's role in the Islamic tradition?
I would say there are a few books written on Jesus in Islam in English. Jeffrey Perinder, Tarif Khalidi, and a few others have written on Jesus in Islam. Despite references from the Quran and early Islamic sources, I would say there is little on Jesus' eschatological role. My original intent with this book was to fill in that gap, actually. Archbishop Fitzgerald, who is well-versed in the area of Quranic studies, says, and I consider this like a good testimony of the book, he says, probably to date, the most complete presentation of the eschatological role of Jesus according to Islam. And I think that's a good testimony from a Christian scholar and also a religious personality. So there are some good reviews of the book. I agree with him that, and actually I couldn't find many books written on the eschatological role of Jesus. Yes, in the Islamic tradition, we have many books. I would say some of them are very inflammatory, some of them are academic, but in the English-speaking world, we have no many books on the eschatological role of Jesus.
So since this is a big focus of your project, could you say a little bit about what eschatology is and how you think about this in relationship to Jesus?
Eschatology, as you know, in the Islamic tradition, there are three major areas. One is called divinity, ilahiyat, or uluhiyye. The second is called nubuwwah, or nubuwat, prophethood. And the third is called Ma'at. Ma'at can be translated as eschatology, actually. The things that related to the end of time. So in this section of Islamic, in this, let's say, field of Islamic theology, we have variety of themes, including the signs of the end of time. The end of time itself, the concept of death, after death, the life after this life. So all of these are a part of Islamic eschatology. And when we look at the signs of the end of time, the signs of the end of time, we see major signs and small signs. Major signs of the afterlife or the events that indicate the coming of the end of time would be the descent of Jesus as one of them, Antichrist, the emergence of Antichrist as one of them. There are some sources that a fire will come from south. It says actually from Yemen. A smoke will come from Yemen or something like that. There are several other things. And the last one, it says, the rise of the sun from the west. So I, when I elaborated on the Antichrist in my thesis, in my PhD dissertation, I found very interesting sources on Jesus. And therefore, Jesus is considered a very important figure with this regard. So he is a part of the eschatological tradition of Islam. And of course, Muslims believe that he will come from sky directly. Many Muslims believe that way. In my book, I divided this concept into three different approaches. I would say I found more than 100 books written on this dimension of Jesus. And I divided them into three categories. One category, I called them modernist approach. Another, I called them literalist approach, another group of scholars. Mostly, I would say, coming from not Salafi in the modern term, but Ahlul Hadith, I would say, the people who are focusing on the literal dimension of the sayings of the Prophet. They think that, yes, the person of Jesus will come directly from sky because the Prophet said this, and God is the most powerful, it will happen that way. But that didn't actually sound very, very, I would say, accurate to me, because in my understanding of Islamic theology, it's not the way that God deals with human beings, to send someone from sky. So I found a different approach, and I favor that approach, and that is understanding of the descent of Jesus in an allegorical way. So that's my approach, allegorical way of the descent of Jesus.
And you're not alone here, right? This isn't just a new idea that people have been thinking about recently. So who are some of the figures that you look at and how they understand the descent as an allegory?
There are prominent scholars, I would say, in early scholars like Al-Halimi has a very interesting approach. Taftazani has a very interesting approach. In our time, a more modern time, Muhammad Abdu has a very interesting approach. And I mentioned all of this in my book. And especially Bediüzzaman Said Nursi has a very interesting approach about this. Again, in an understanding this concept in an allegorical way.
This strikes me, I see a connection here in terms of there's this idea that there's been a competing discourse throughout history. And maybe like the Isaac and Ishmael story is similar. Early exegetes thought that Isaac was the sacrificed son, and then later it became Ishmael. But oftentimes we take these things for granted in the modern context and assume there's just sort of one Islamic idea. And so I think that's one of the great things you do in your book is you survey how there's been really different ideas, not just about Jesus and his role in the end times, but specific things like what it might mean to descend from the sky. And so was that an important point that you're trying to get across, that there are a lot of different ideas about who Jesus has been?
Absolutely. I would say I found out that really the concept is not monolithic. We have variety of ideas, approaches. So it shows a great pluralism of views in this Islamic eschatological theme.
And so you mentioned that you looked at over 100 books and you look at things in all sorts of different languages. So as you began to undertake this project, how did you decide where to look and what kinds of texts you would look at and which languages you would look at?
I would say, like any scholar of Islamic theology, I began with the Quran. Is this concept mentioned in the Quran? And then I look at the Hadith of the Prophet and Muslim commentators on the Quran and the Hadith. I try to be looking at all this thoroughly. Not, you know, like a general looking, but actually going into the depth of these sources. I have to say my approach is more analytical rather than just, you know, taking some sources and using as is. I look at contemporary debates regarding traditional and modernist approaches. For example, Mustafa Sabri, Mohammed Zahid al-Kawseri, and also Mahmoud Sheltut. These figures have debated the subject tremendously, unbelievably. So I elaborated on their debates as well. I also examined Christian and Jewish sources from time to time as they became relevant.
And so, yeah, thinking about how Christians and Jews think about Jesus, and of course Muslims think about Jesus differently, but there's a lot of overlap. So one thing is in the Quran, Jesus is thought about as the Word and the Messiah. And so how do these similarities distinguish themselves subtly from Christian understanding? So the Messiah, for example, what does that mean for Muslims that Jesus is the Messiah?
Well, the commentators of the Quran would look at this term, because this is a term that is used only for Jesus in the Quran. We have 28 prophets named in the Quran, but this is a title that given only to Jesus in the Quran. So I try to find out what is the meaning of Al-Masih or the Messiah. Generally, it is understood as the anointed one, not a person that is understood like the Christ concept that's understood in the Christian tradition, but because Jesus and Prophet Muhammad and Prophet Moses, all these messengers of God, are not saviors per se, because the concept of Al-Messiah, the one who saves, yes, they give a message, but the one who saves is God, actually. God is, these are the messengers of God. So maybe with that regard, it, you know, I did not elaborate too much on this concept itself, Al-Masih, but I found out that generally in the Islamic tradition, it's understood as the anointed one rather than the term that has a Christian connotation.
So connecting this back to some of the interfaith work you're involved, what do you see as some of the chief challenges in terms of Muslims and Christians discussing sometimes overt and sometimes subtle theological differences around Jesus? Do you have any tips or strategies that you would recommend for people that want to set up dialogues around Jesus?
I think they can set up dialogue around Jesus because I think they can acknowledge the differences. And in my book, I argue that not only Muslims and Christians, but Muslims, Christians, and Jews can all come together. I have a chapter, the last chapter of the book actually is about interfaith dialogue. And one of these scholars who understand the coming of Jesus in an allegorical way suggests that the meaning of this is a cooperation between Christians and Muslims coming together. So they may acknowledge their differences, but that those differences should not be obstacles against their coming together and their communication and their cooperation. So I think Jesus can play an important role with this regard.
And so again, on this note of how different thinkers understand Jesus differently, and you survey so many different scholars, who are some of the ones that struck you in particular as meaningful? So you look at Nursi, for example, and also Sufi thinkers, and what you've referred to as Salafi thinkers, which obviously encompasses a large spectrum. So who are some of your favorite?
I would say the one that actually was striking me the most, I would say Nursi. Nursi speaks a lot about Jesus. First, he speaks about how he is alive now. Very interesting. Many Muslim scholars believe that Jesus is alive, still alive. So he says there are 5 levels of life, and Jesus is in one of these levels. So when we say a person is alive, it's not only one level, but there are several levels of life. So he gives a very good information about this. Then he speaks about the coming of Jesus, the descent of Jesus. And he says, and he's a pioneer in this regard, I would say he said this in his famous sermon to a certain extent, I would say. Later he elaborated further in his sermon that he gave in the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus in 1911. In this sermon, he focuses on the diseases of the Islamic world and how they can be cured. He actually provides cures for their diseases. And one of the things that he strongly emphasizes is Muslim-Christian cooperation. He says, ittifaq, alliance. In this such early time, talking about this almost 50 years before the Nostra Aetate, important. It is really important. And then later in his writings, he elaborates this concept of the descent of Jesus as actually the fulfillment of this cooperation. If this happens, and then in some of his other books, like in his dialogues, which is known as Al-Munazarat, he speaks of the people of the book in a more general term. So Christians, Muslims, and Jews, basically the people of the book in the Quran, is a term, referring to Christians and Jews. So I also found him very interesting scholar among all the scholars that I studied and worked on them.
And so going back to this idea of the descent, so if some of the figures you looked at are thinking about this allegorically, how have Muslims set themselves up to be able to identify Jesus when he comes, whether it's in an allegorical or a literal sense?
Well, if we understand in an allegorical way, then actually you don't have to recognize Jesus when he comes. You know, it's not a matter of finding a person. As Muhammad Abdu says, the essence of the message of Jesus is love, mercy, and peace. If these three concepts dominate human society, that means Jesus is there. Or if you work for these three concepts, actually you are working with Jesus. You are actually on that pattern, on that way that is expected for the end of time and for the human society. So basically, there is no such a thing that, according to the allegorical meaning, I would say, that you have to recognize Jesus. Nursi even has a very interesting approach. He says, the personality of Jesus after he was ascended by God to heaven has become like an angelic personality. So he may come and then go, he may come and may go back and without being even noticed, because angels are, you know, angels can be in variety of places and then can be here and then can be, you know, in a different place and without being noticed. So it's not a person anymore, actually. And therefore, even the concept of Nuzul, I elaborated in my book, that Nuzul, for example, can be used in a variety of terms. Nuzul al-Matar, the coming of the coming of rain. Nuzul al-Malaika, the coming of angels. So when they come, do we see angels? No. So Nuzul not necessarily to be a physical coming to earth so that everybody will be able to see. But that is not actually, I would say, understood by those who think in a literal way, because I communicate with some of these people and they really believe that Jesus will come directly from sky. And I remember once I said to one of them, I said, so you believe that when Jesus comes, CNN, ABC will have interview with him? And he said, yes, absolutely, because the prophet promised this, and that's the way that will happen. Jesus will come directly.
So when you have conversations with them, did you have any opportunities to exchange perspectives and challenge ideas and get pushback at all?
I would say yes, because when I argued and I said, okay, so if God is the most powerful, which is true, the Quran says, وَهُوَ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ, God is the most powerful over everything. Okay, then why God does not make, let's say, an apple from the seed of an apple in 10 seconds? God is powerful. God can make it, but God doesn't do that, because as we have the power of God, we also have the wisdom of God. Hikmatullah. The wisdom of God in this world works differently, not according to the power of God, but according to the wisdom of God, the things are happening. And therefore, the wisdom of God does not actually allow for a person coming from sky with parachute. The personality of Jesus will come from sky. So there is a hikmah here. And the prophet spoke allegorical language. I found interesting evidences that the prophet spoke in an allegorical language. For example, in one occasion, Aisha, the wife of the prophet, asked him, which of us will meet you the first after your death? Which means, which of us will die first? And the prophet says, the one whose hand is the longest. And Aisha says, we started measuring our hands. Whose hands are the longest? But then later, the one whose hand was the shortest died. Then we understood that the prophet meant the one who gives charity the most. So the prophet used allegorical language because allegorical language is a part of Arabic eloquence.
So obviously this is a really big question, right? When we're thinking about religious traditions and religious texts, how do we know when to look at something allegorically? So having thought about this question a lot from the particular angle of thinking about Jesus, do you have any general thoughts on how, not just with the Islamic tradition, but in general, how people can answer this question in a meaningful and reasonable way?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a very important question. There are some criteria, I would say. At least what you say should be allegorical has to meet with the criteria of the methodology of the hadith and the methodology of the common tafsir, the commentary of the Quran. Because these two fields of Islamic disciplines have certain methodologies. In order to avoid esotericism, because that is another danger, to become a bataniyeh, you say everything is allegorical, okay, the entire Quran is allegorical, that is also not appropriate. There is a methodology. And generally, I would say Al-Shatibi has a great methodology in this regard. I would recommend that one has to read Al-Shatibi in this regard. And there are contemporary methodologies, like Muhammad Abu Zahra also wrote a very beautiful methodology of these disciplines. So I would say that it has to meet those methodological sources. But if we say just one statement about this, when allegorical interpretation is appropriate, basically when the literal interpretation is not appropriate, then allegorical interpretation becomes necessary. Because the prophet does not speak in vain. the Quran says. So if he does not speak in vain, and if he says something that is not within the limit of logic, the limit of reason, then there should be another meaning for it. So, well, that is the idea. If you think that this is possible because God is the most powerful, that is not the way to, you know, to approach the text. Basically, God is the most powerful to do everything. So, and that's why scholars who are really versed in the area, they focus on eschatological themes in an allegorical way. And we see this in prominent figures as well.
So along the lines of this topic, so you talked about Nursi as someone who resonated with you in particular. Were there authors you looked at that challenged you in particular ways and opened up doors that you hadn't thought about before you undertook the project?
I would say some early scholars, I would never expect that, for example, Al-Halimi would have something on this, who is considerably an early Islamic scholar. And I would not also think that there will be Islamic scholars who would deny this totally. Like Abdul Karim al-Khatib, for example, he says this is totally nonsense. You know, these are all traditions are fabricated, and they are under the influence of Christian and Jewish traditions. There is no such a thing that Jesus will come. Nuzul Isa is not found in any Islamic sources. And yet, like Al-Kashmiri, for example, this Indian Islamic scholar, put together about 100 sayings of the Prophet on the descent of Jesus. And I would say that was also striking because, I mean, you can deny some of them. Yes, there are many fabricated sayings of the Prophet. Al-Suyuti put together several volumes, called them, called his book Al-Ali al-Masnu'a, the artificial pearls, the artificial pearls, not real pearls, but artificial. But there are very prominent and very sound sayings of the Prophet, on the, especially on the coming of Jesus. So that was also striking because, I mean, it's easy to say, well, none of them are reliable, and therefore just, I think it will be as easy as those who say, he is coming directly from sky. I remember once I was giving a talk on this, I think it was in Arizona, a gentleman, a Muslim, raised his hand and he said, I like the literalist approach. And I said, why? And he said, because that is easy. Just believe in it and leave it. God will take care of it. Don't worry about the interpretations. Well, I said, for you, it is easy, but for me, it is challenging. How you can expect, you know, a person coming from sky directly? Well, for me, as a scholar of Islamic theology, really, it is perplexing and challenging.
So for people that wanted to reject the role of Jesus in Islamic eschatology, what do you think was at stake for them, given that this was part of the tradition and they wanted to reject the scholarship that was pointing towards Jesus as part of eschatological reasoning?
I think the main reason they think that is unreasonable. The main reason is their understanding of the subject as unreasonable. Because it doesn't sound reasonable to have a person coming from sky. I don't know, for example, scholars like Abdul Karim al-Khatib, if they found something with regard to allegorical commentaries. For example, I don't know if he was aware of Al-Taftazani's writings. He might be aware, but I don't know if he really found those specific information. So I think that if they would be more aware of the allegorical interpretation, they would not be so much denying altogether.
So it sounds like your own project is a model for how to think about the larger picture, since you survey so many different traditions and aren't necessarily favoring one over the other, even if you have your own sorts of ideas. And so one thing you do in the book, which I think is particularly provocative given the state of Islamic studies, is that you give particular attention to Turkish thinkers. And so since Turkish scholars are underutilized, as is the Turkish language, in the study of Islam today, what are some of the original contributions that the Turkish scholars you've studied make to this conversation about Jesus's role in Islam and Islamic eschatology?
I think I found among Turkish scholars basically Nursi as the most important one. And also I found El-Malili Muhammad Hamdi Yazır. He's a prominent commentator of the Quran. I think both of them were, I used, their ideas. I benefited from their ideas. Nursi, more specifically, is talking about the descent of Jesus, but Yazır speaks of the descent of Jesus sometimes in a very philosophical way, I would say. Used part of his commentary, a few pages, and translated into English, and put as an appendix, for my book. And I think this is the first time available in English. Among scholars that also are influential and really well-versed in the Hadith, I would say Fethullah Gülen, since he is alive, and I said I have to have his opinion on the subject. So I sent him five questions, and he kindly responded in an article format. And I also put that as an appendix at the end of my book. The reason I wanted this because I think that Turkish scholars should be more recognized. In American academia, generally in Western academia, they are not very well known. For example, Nursi's writings are translated, but I think they are not very well known. And also maybe translations are not very good. So I said once I was translating some of Nursi's writings for my own work, and I said, I wish Nursi had Reynold Nicholson, a person like Reynold Nicholson that who translated Rumi to English. If Nursi had someone like Reynold Nicholson, he would be a remarkable personality in the Western world because he has so fresh ideas, really, so unique ideas that I did not find among early Islamic scholars and even contemporary Islamic scholars. So I think they should be recognized at least to a certain extent. I don't think that this is intentionally done, and I think it is because of the lack of the translation, a good translation of their works.
And so is there anything besides that, do you think, that prevents scholars from paying more attention to Turkish scholarship? So it's the lack of translations from things from Turkish into English. Do you think there's anything
I think
else at stake?
One more thing maybe is a factor. I think sometimes when we think of Islam, we think directly Arabic, because the Quran is Arabic. And while Arabs are those who brought Islam to humanity, so who are Turks? They are secondary, like in the era of Islamic studies. But I think Turks have contributed greatly. Fazlur Rahman, in one of his, articles says, the level of scholarship among Turkish scholars is considerably high. But this is not very well known. And I think maybe additional to the factor that you mentioned, this is also like a kind of background in the mind of people. I remember once I was in Cairo attending a book fair there. And when I said I am Turkish, she said, can you recite the first chapter of the Quran? So the idea was that a Turkish person cannot even recite the first chapter of the Quran, among some people. That should not be in academia, but maybe to a certain extent can be found, at least to a certain extent, sometimes can be a factor as well.
So on this note of spreading knowledge to broad audiences, what kinds of opportunities have you had to use your scholarship with your teaching with students? And has that changed now that your book is published?
Well, I think, I mean, my teaching style is continuing, but because my students are sometimes referring to my book, and sometimes we have discussion of it, especially when we come to the concept of Jesus in Islam. Well, I think it is very good to have something that student can see, in a concrete way. When they look at it, they can really make a sense of it. And my goal was not to use a very academic language that will not be really relevant to college students. They can really understand it, and that's what is promising for me. Jonathan Brown of Georgetown says this is a book that academics and non-academics can really enjoy reading it. So that was my goal, actually, to make it accessible for academics and non-academics as well.
And I think that's one of the strengths of the book, particularly because it's a topic that so many people will resonate with. Just when they see the title, it's very intriguing, and English speakers know about Jesus, and then, oh, Jesus has something to do with Islam. That surprises a lot of people. So are there any kind of particular student reactions that have stood out to you where they had sort of a revelation of insight or connected some dots that you've noticed in your teaching?
I have noticed a lot, I would say. In fact, a Muslim student came to me and he said, Dr. Sarah Toprak, I read your book, I finished it, and I have to say the book changed my approach completely about Jesus in the Islamic understanding, and I have to thank you for this new approach.
What do you think, what changed for him in particular?
I think he was thinking literally,
uh-huh.
And it was challenging for him, because that's what I understood from he did not want to reject the sayings of the prophet, because rejecting the sayings of the prophet is actually destroying your faith. So he was, like between either to accept blindly or to reject it. And so when he read my book, I think it gave him, a very interesting approach, that he found a reconciliation between his faith and the sayings of the prophet.
Yeah, so I mean, challenging students, right? It's one of our missions as professors. So it's always great to hear these kinds of stories. So, before we conclude, I know that you're working on several other projects and are busy organizing conferences and traveling around. So, could you tell us a little bit about your current and upcoming projects that you're thinking about over the next few years?
My current project is actually a book project. I'm working on it now, and inshallah, I will be finishing by the end of this year. That's my promise for the publisher. It is tentatively called Islamic Spirituality, Theology and Practice for a Modern Time. So I hope that it will be a good source for those who are interested in Islamic spirituality. I have many other projects on my mind. Some people ask me if I would like to write a book on Islam's Moses. Well, I think it's well deserved, and if I have time, God willing, I may do something on that. I have an idea to write a complete tafsir, if God gives me, a long life, a tafsir of the Quran, which is not available. I did something, and I found out that it will be great to have not only translation of the Quran, but a commentary of the Quran based on my understanding, especially having reading Western sources, Christian, Jewish sources, and Islamic sources. It will be very good to have like a large tafsir on the Quran. But that is, you know, like a 20 years project, you know. I'm not sure that I will do it. It's on my mind, basically.
Well, this all sounds like very exciting research and interest. And so since I happen to know and have been involved with the Spiritual Jihad Conference that has just concluded at John Carroll University, could you say a little bit about that conference and how that's related to your scholarship and academic interests more broadly?
We have at John Carroll University, we have a chair in Islamic studies. It is called Bediüzzaman Said Nursi Chair in Islamic Studies, named after Nursi, actually, supported by several Muslim businessmen. We have events, we have conferences, we organize conferences. And this year, the year 2015 conference was on spiritual jihad. Basically, everybody speaks about jihad. You know, we have, unfortunately, people who are using this term of jihad to kill people. And that's why we said, let's find something more significant in the Islamic teaching, and that is spiritual jihad, which is not very well known. Everybody knows about jihad as a physical one, as a force, as a violence, but no one speaks of jihad that is spiritual, that is actually jihad against yourself, against your own inclinations, jihad as a positive behaviors, as a positive action, rather than destroying jihad as a building. So we decided to have this conference, and we had really a good number of scholars, including yourself. I'm very pleased that the conference went very well. People showed a great interest in the conference. I think a good number of people stayed until from the beginning of the conference until the end of the conference. So I found that as a kind of sign of a great interest in the subject. It is important because we need this jihad. We need this spiritual jihad. In our world, a world that is just yesterday, you know, over 100 people were killed by these people who are considered themselves as performing jihad, which is distortion of the teaching of Islam. But these people are known as Muslims. I call them Muslims with capital M, but not Muslims with lowercase m. So we need more about the spiritual dimension of religion. And I think that will bring people together. And I think that will be very helpful in communicating with each other and also coming together.
Well, thank you so much, Time, for taking the time to chat, Zaki. And it's been a real pleasure to engage with your work, especially around topics that are of broad public interest. And I think you do an absolutely wonderful job of striking that fine balance between real erudite scholarship while at the same time keeping it accessible to broad audiences. And I really appreciate our opportunity to chat.
Thank you very much, Elliot. It was a great pleasure talking with you.
That was my conversation with Zeki Sari Toprak, professor of theology and religious studies and director of the Bediüzzaman Said Nursi Chair in Islamic Studies at John Carroll University, about his exciting book, Islam's Jesus, published by the University of Florida Press in 2015. Thank you for listening.